Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. He's Leighton Kling. And while it's a bit of an earnings fest this week, it is earnings season after all, it's not all numbers on this edition of the Retail Focus. We cover a vast array of retailers today, including farm and home, auto parts, lease ownership, and supplements. And we'll start with real estate and grocery, as it turns out. Not covering Amazon, there's enough other people talking about Amazon's profit miss today, but instead we're going to branch out and talk about some areas of retail that don't get as much press. A quick reminder, if you like us and like the Retail Focus, be sure to rate us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be accessing us from. We always appreciate our listener feedback, and here in about a week, we'll also have a listener survey. It's an annual listener survey to make sure we're getting you the best possible content tailored to your wants and needs out of a podcast. So with that being said, with all the media talk of a brick and mortar retail apocalypse that we've been getting, with all this talk this week about how Amazon and Whole Foods is scaring retailers, Kimco Realty, a real estate investment trust, shows that there are indeed bright spots in brick and mortar in retail with stellar earnings. Their earnings were for the second quarter ending June 30th, 2017. On the earnings per share front, they met analyst expectations. That's not why their stock popped on the market this Thursday. We'll get to that in a bit. First, a quick bit about Kimco before Leighton gives you the earnings. Kimco is a real estate investment trust, or a REIT, based in New York, but the reason they're of specific importance to us is that most of their portfolio is in retail real estate. The vast majority of their portfolio is in this area, particularly open-air shopping centers, which, as we've noted in the past, they've been outperforming their self-contained mall cousins, and we see that certainly in this earnings report. As of April 1st this year, Kimco had 510 shopping centers, over 4,100 tenants sprinkled throughout the country in multiple markets. It should be noted that most of their holdings are in mid to large size markets, so they've been relatively untouched by this small market retail downturn we talk of when we speak of Ascena Retail and also retailers like Hibbett Sports. They currently have 21 disposition properties on the market. That means basically they're looking to sell those properties, but they're actively seeking acquisitions in 31 different markets. And more interesting, right now, Kimco is seeking properties that are anchored by what they call the dominant grocery brand of that region, whatever that may happen to be. This year alone, they've acquired managing interests in four shopping centers sprinkled throughout the country. They're in Chicago, Columbia, Maryland, Philadelphia, Reno, and then also recently they closed on a property in the Portland, Oregon metro area and acquired a development parcel next to an existing Kimco holding in Augusta, Georgia. They claim diversification of area, not holdings, but area, size of their holdings and size of their company, and consistent relationships with larger tenants, one being Target actually, as keys to their success. And success is exactly what we saw, Leighton, from this earnings call.
Yeah, with a large REIT like this, it's very interesting because they do rely on those larger operators, those kind of mall anchors, if you will, even though they operate in the strip mall arena. But you see that net income on a GAAP basis came in at $131.9 million or 31 cents per share, which is indeed down since last year, coming in earnings per share wise at 46 cents per share. The decline is blamed on proceeds from shopping center sales in 2016. They sold 34 shopping centers for $695 million in the second quarter of 2016 versus just nine for $152.2 million for this year's second quarter. If you adjust for this, the net income from continuing operations is actually a tick higher this year. While this number appears scary and indicative of decline, perhaps more important is their National Association of Real Estate Investment Trust, FFO, or funds from operations, which was up $175 million this year versus $158 million last year. And if you look at what that means, the National Association of Real Estate Investment Trusts implemented a standard funds from operations definition in 1991, and it was most recently clarified in 2002. There's actually been several iterations of it throughout the 1990s as they've adjusted it to what the REITs want as a standard definition of funds from operations. But this was brought about to help people entering the industry, as well as potential REIT stakeholders and shareholders, to analyze the financial strength of a REIT beyond just those GAAP measures that are reported through earnings reports such as this one we're reporting now. Therefore, the non-GAAP approach, which is this, is one that the SEC recognizes as a standard practice, but not one that companies, especially REITs, are required to report. The measure has evolved to include certain one-time costs in the overall earnings that REITs have beyond the common recurring benefits, including things like amortization and depreciation in this common metric. And most owners of commercial real estate benefit greatly from expensing things like depreciation, which in turn reduces their effective tax rate and their increase in net operating income. And in 2002, when they kind of adjusted some things, clarified some things for their funds from operations definition, certain assets were available to be included, such as those that were sold or going to be sold or otherwise transferred, and included results from discontinued operations. And they said that all of these things can be included in the consolidated funds from operations. So I just said a lot. Basically, what I'm saying is, in the funds from operations, it's sort of a reconciled way to include everything, all the estimations that the company has put in. And that's why it's a non-GAAP measure, because a lot of times they're accounting for things that haven't yet happened. And then also they're accounting for things such as depreciation and amortization that a lot of companies are able to expense on their accounting reports, but they're doing it in a way that gets ahead of the curve and really brings to light how the company is performing overall. And for Kimco, they do a solid job of disclosure. We see an increase in their funds from operations was largely due to the cash distribution they received in their stake in Albertsons. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Overall, companies, it's up to them to disclose what they feel is necessary for their particular REIT shareholders. You see a lot of disclosure forms including everything, certain properties, certain parts of the country that they think are going to be overperforming and underperforming. And Kimco, like I said, for their part, does a really great job in transparency from their investor relations website. And what investors liked, they raised guidance for all of 2017 as well. You see net income up from previous guidance of 64 cents to 67 cents a share to now 78 to 82 cents a share. Also, funds from operations up from $1.50 to $1.54 a share to now in between a range of $1.53 and $1.57 a share. Most REITs are defined by their dividend, and Kimco, they still have a modest dividend at 27 cents per share, about a 5.3 annual return based on its current share price, which is actually slightly below certain REITs in this particular sector. And you see operations from Kimco, a lot of strategic talking about the years ahead, a 2020 vision. What are some of their goals going forward, looking to expand their presence?
So you mentioned 2020 vision. That's actually their strategic plan that they released a few years ago, wherein their goal was to divest smaller market shopping centers and buy into larger shopping centers in larger markets. Basically, they wanted a trade-off between total number of properties, as they would sell multiple properties in smaller markets and buy maybe a single or maybe two properties in a larger area. So this was a trade-off that they felt like would pay off long-term. And in this, they were about a year ahead of the rest of the REIT industry as far as retail goes. As we've talked about the increasing struggles of C and D level shopping centers, particularly in those small to mid-sized markets, Kimco began exiting those markets prior to when many REITs started backing out of those markets, and it seems to have paid dividends operationally for their organization. They completely exited Maine and Louisiana in this last quarter as a result of this strategic plan that they're trying to execute. Now, the plan is paying off in fairly high prorated portfolio occupancy numbers, 95.5% at the end of the second quarter, meaning 95.5% of all their available lease area is occupied currently, which is fairly high for a retail REIT. Their second quarter acquisition of Janssen Beach Shopping Center in Portland has an existing occupancy rate of 96%. But not only do you see a high occupancy rate there, They have potential outparcel pads for development that could then build into the revenue they're bringing in from that shopping center. And outparcels are something that they've focused on in terms of acquiring new shopping centers. Basically, these outparcels are freestanding structures or yet to be built structures near a shopping center. Sometimes you'll see these used for restaurants. TGI Fridays is one of those restaurants that does like to establish themselves in these outparcels. Sometimes you'll see this used for additional retailers. But Kimco as a whole continues to target properties for acquisition that actually have grocers or applicable specialty stores as tenants. And this move, this pivot to grocers, is something that's relatively new for Kimco as a whole. And when you look at their purchase in Reno, Nevada, that property is actually anchored by a Whole Foods. That's the only Whole Foods in Reno, which Kimco actually mentioned in their earnings call. And you might say, well, Whole Foods same-store sales was down. They were reported to be struggling in this week's earnings report. But this location in Reno benefits not only from the fact that there's only one Whole Foods in the city, but also an increased tech presence and a growing area population. So it's one Whole Foods to serve a growing area population, and Kimco sees that as a win. The same center also has the only area Sierra Trading Post, which is a TJX retailer. This is important because there are significant recreation opportunities nearby in Reno, but one of the most important things coming from this call was a look into the financials of Albertsons. Now, Albertsons, as a grocer, a privately held retailer, one of the largest retailers in the country, but Kimco is in a rare position of holding a 10% stake in Albertsons, Leighton, and we got to see from this earnings call exactly how successful Albertsons has been of late.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see that Albertsons most likely is as profitable as some of their larger competitors. And here recently, we had talked about Albertsons on another edition of the podcast. And they are now delaying their IPO because the deal, the proposed deal between Amazon and Whole Foods. Amazon, of course, is proposing to buy out Whole Foods. But you see overall that the $12.4 billion valuation that Albertsons has put up in the past, they tried to have an IPO in 2015 and then most recently delayed another proposed IPO. That $12.4 billion valuation isn't out of the realm of possibility. If you do the quick back of the napkin math, based on that $23.7 million cash distribution or cash dividend that Kimco got here from Albertsons via their 10% stake, that is fairly normalized in this particular market. Right now, Kroger has about a 2.07% dividend. And if you do a 2% dividend based on a $12.4 billion valuation for Albertsons, you come up with some math that gets you right around that $24 million level. So chances are Albertsons is performing as well as some of their larger competitors, which is a good sign if they do want to end up having an IPO in the future after everything passes from the Amazon Whole Foods deal and everything in the grocery sector starts to settle down. So while Albertsons is still privately held, public companies do have to disclose distributions from their stake in these companies. So it's very interesting to get this look inside here. The original investment was around $51 million in the mid-2000s from Kimco. This might be one of the best business decisions in the grocery space in the last three decades because of that rate of return. Just in a couple years, they're able to actually pay that off through these types of dividend payments. They mentioned the potential of partially monetizing the stake in late 2016 at the right opportunity. One might speculate that this would happen around another IPO date. However, anytime, Trent, that you're getting these large $23, $24 million cash distributions, one would suggest maybe you'd try to shy away from the idea of trying to sell your 10% stake. But this was one of the leaders in their press release. You see, as they reported their second quarter 2017 results, this was actually the second line saying that the company receives a $24 million distribution from Albertsons LLC. So overall, this suggests a pretty high rate of return for Albertsons, one of the largest private retailers in the United States.
We move now to auto parts. O'Reilly Auto Parts hits the brakes on a brief auto parts sector skid. They did show positive comps, albeit comps beneath what the company had expected, and a substantial increase in earnings over last year. These earnings are for quarter two of fiscal year 2017, just as with Kimco. These were released on July 26th, so just a couple days ago. Perhaps I think the best part of this release, if you're looking at it from an analyst perspective or a retailer perspective, or even a shareholder perspective, was that Greg Hensley, the O'Reilly Auto Parts CEO, said that comps were disappointing. Despite same-store sales declines of 0.8% at Counterpart AutoZone and 2.7% declines at Advance Auto Parts, in each of their latest quarters, O'Reilly's comps went up nearly 2%. Now, this is fitting in terms of Hensley's attitude, as O'Reilly has performed better on the stock market than its rivals, but the industry hasn't looked good overall after much talk of the sector's strength during 2016. AutoZone shares down 35% for the 52-week period, Advance down 35%, and O'Reilly down 30% to date from the last 52 weeks. Now, this comes as years of momentum and aging automobiles have caused people to stay excited about the auto parts industry, thus causing a little bit of a bubble, if you will. However, many fail to take into consideration that vehicles are generally now more reliable and now they also have wider maintenance intervals, meaning they need serviced less frequently, whether that service is happening at an auto shop or actually happening based on the user going to an auto parts store like O'Reilly. Now let's get to results before we get to statements from management. Net income did grow, as I mentioned, 10% to $283 million or $3.10 a share. Now again, that is a bottom line number. Grew as a percentage of sales too, from 11.8% to 12.3%. Earnings per share beat expectations by 20 cents. So you see, despite Hensley's comments and despite the fact that he wants to see better results, these results are already pretty good, especially versus analyst expectations. Gross margins rose from 51.8% to 52.4% of sales. So margins also increasing, and revenue for the company hit a record $2.29 billion, up 5%. This was right in line with analysts from Wall Street. Mentioned those same-store sales numbers. Those were up 1.7%. They're the largest auto parts retailer to show a same-store sales improvement year over year from this last quarter. Selling, general, and administrative expenses did increase 10 basis points as a percentage of sales, but they're still in a growth pattern. As we looked at O'Reilly's store openings and closures during this last quarter, they opened 50 stores and closed 4. They now have nearly 5,000 locations, so average unit volume, maybe not huge, but it's still enough to get the job done for O'Reilly. They have 4,934 stores at the conclusion of this quarter, and they're expected to go up over the 5,000 mark later in the year. Average sales per store, so here's where you get that average unit volume. These actually decreased from $466,000 in the second quarter to $463,000. This is reflective mostly of softness in their new store openings, as you see the same store sales numbers going up, yet the average unit volumes decreasing ever so slightly.
Trent, you had mentioned some pessimism through Greg Hensley, their CEO, as he reaffirmed that it is indeed a challenging environment despite the strong numbers overall that they brought in for the quarter. Throughout the conference call, they blamed several factors outside of their control, which is always interesting. In any sort of retail environment, you and I tend to dislike those types of things when you're blaming things outside of your control. You tend to focus on things and promises you've made internally throughout the past few quarters and then how they reflect in the current results. But you see that a mild winter reduced the amount of what they called parts failures in certain automobiles and those older automobiles that handle winters a little more rougher than others. And he said that they don't like talking about winter, but they do have to address the reality of what's happened, and we can respect that. However, at the end of the day, they devoted an entire paragraph to this in the conference call, and you see that a lot of things outside their control, they really need to be addressing how they can hedge against this in the future. So, for instance, if you have a harsh winter or a mild winter, you need to be able to move and enable the business to be agile enough to react to these types of happenings throughout the country. Obviously, different parts of the country have different weather conditions, so it's hard on the macroeconomic front to adjust, but overall, a business this large, Trent, you mentioned over 4,900 locations, they're big enough and large enough and have the management power enough to be able to adjust to things like this, this industry softness throughout effects of a mild winter. But you see, consumer softness was cited for their industry, ties back to the car reliability prospects going forward. This wasn't mentioned, but cars now often require less oil changes and filter changes, something we prefaced with at the beginning of the story. More and more a lot of cars sold, a lot of popular car brands are now touting the fact that you only have to change your oil every 10 or 12,000 miles in some cases. So I think this is going to hurt their industry overall. And then a lot of, like you said, new dealerships are promoting the fact that they have service centers. They offer a lot of rebates for people to come in and get their car serviced. And then also, when you buy a newer car, a lot of opportunities to get that car serviced for free during the first brief period of time, 1 to 3 years that you have that car. So all of these things end up taking a ding out of O'Reilly's overall market share and their income. And you see that the lower income demographics are also not as confident in the market. Lower income demographics are very popular with O'Reilly because they have the older generation cars. And you have to wonder if this is not a bigger target customer than they realize now with the other competitors coming to the market. Despite all of this talk, besides some of the pessimism throughout the conference call, they said near the end that they're still positioned to grow via several factors. And they said a continued focus on in-store customer service and building those longer-term relationships with the customer. And as always, now that we've followed the auto parts industry for quite some time, Trent, you could see sort of a trend here with O'Reilly and Greg Hensley as the CEO. He always says at the end of the press release and at the end of the earnings call, both, that every customer who walks in or walks through the doors every day, their relentless dedication to taking care of that customer is going to make them successful, and that exceptional customer service is going to be their key for sustainability in the future. And you think that those longer term relationships are extremely important, but again, it's very nice to take care of your employees and to try to drive home the idea that customer service equals long-term success. However, it is an important feature to understand that is it necessarily an important facet of the aftermarket car parts business? It's now really commoditized, and we've talked recently about how Amazon has come into the fray, and I most recently actually bought an air filter for one of my cars on Amazon because it was about 50% cheaper than my local AutoZone. So at the end of the day, you really have to understand, is it that dynamic between the customer relationships and the employees that's going to make them survive, or is it going to be the price point now that the products are commoditized? And I think right now it's going to be the price point if you look in the short to midterm. And I would not be surprised if you see those margins come down as a result, as they try to compete with these emerging competitors in the online space and others throughout the industry. Overall, the company is very poised. They're saying the right things. It's a matter of whether they're going to do the right things in the future quarters.
Very briefly, O'Reilly has been bullish about repurchasing shares. They repurchased a ton of shares this quarter, 3.5 million shares to be exact, for $852 million. This is a result of the positive cash flow from the last 2 years of business, which has been very solid for O'Reilly's. Their average share price now currently sits around $245 per share. Now, the fact that they did buy so many shares in this last quarter might be advantageous for the company long term, considering that their share price is down 30% over the last 52 weeks, as we led off the story with. Some had questioned what value there might be in share repurchasing as opposed to maybe more online reinvestment, but still, shareholders were relatively pleased, it would appear, with the repurchasing program, and they were pleased, no doubt, with this earnings release. Shares were up nearly 8% on Thursday, right after the release came out and after the earnings call. They came back over the $200 mark, recent relative lows of $173 per share. They were up near $300 per share about a year ago. O'Reilly's price-to-earnings ratio is now pretty fair at 17 times market cap of $18.32 billion. 17 price-to-earnings ratio seems about right for a company that's expanding still, but expanding a little bit more slowly.
We move on to more positivity as Tractor Supply Company's stock popped nearly 10% after revealing same-store sales back in the positive for their second quarter. Founded in 1938 and headquartered in Brentwood, Tennessee, just outside of Nashville, the results for their second quarter ended July 1st, 2017, given after market close on Wednesday, July 26th. And when the stock popped, it took place during Thursday's trading as the market liked what they saw from the long-term farm and outdoors retailer. And we see that one headline read, Tractor Supply Company does bounce back. Somewhat odd that the reportings they had and revenue reflected analyst misses. So despite the stock going up, they did miss on a few key financial metrics. We see earnings per share for the company came in at $1.25 versus estimates of $1.27. So while that's a mild 2-cent miss, they did miss overall. And earnings per share did increase year over year, however, by about 7.8%. So that 7.8% figure is probably what analysts and shareholders are now hanging their hat on for that stock pop. Top line revenue grew nearly 9%, bringing in $2.01 billion versus the $2.02 that was expected by Zacks consensus estimates. Same store sales did increase that 2.2%. And there's actually two positives to draw from that same store sales, those comp numbers there. One is it beat the negative 0.5% comps that came in for the same period last year. And two, the growth was mainly due to transactions. So oftentimes, Trent and I talk about the number of transactions and the growth there versus the basket size or the amount per transaction. But in this case, it was transactions that were growing in markets throughout. And these actually weren't concentrated to one part of the country either. They said their growth has been diversified when it comes to transaction growth. However, the basket size was actually neutral for this quarter. But if you're going to have one over the other, we tend to prefer to see transaction growth in general. And overall, you see the company is firing on all cylinders as selling, general, and administrative costs grew as a percent of sales, 22.1%. And this is as a result of higher marketing expenditures. And as a result, operating income then shrank to 12.8% of sales, even though the overall dollar amount grew to $257 million. Again, I think with this conference call, with this press release, I think you're saying that shareholders are more excited about the cumulative dollar amounts instead of the actual growth figures. They did have a lot of areas of excitement. You see a lot of areas in their stores that have been performing very well for this last quarter.
Strong merchandise segments for Tractor Supply included livestock and pets. Now, in terms of pets, we recently discussed Aldi's Bargain Outlet and seeing so much success in the pet section of their merchandise, in the pet section of their store. We should recall that Tractor Supply owns PetSense, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. 160 PetSense stores nationwide, but they're mostly in the Midwest. They're encouraging expansion in this brand, in part because of strength in pet sales. PetSense locations now, they also offer grooming and the like, so they go a little bit beyond just retailing of products. The American Pet Products Association estimates that $69.36 billion will be spent in the U.S. pet industry this year. Now, of course, not all of that is going to Tractor Supply Co. or PetSense, but that's still a 3.9% increase over 2016 numbers, meaning that on the macro level, we notice that pet sales is mentioned by a number of different retailers. Tractor Supply is not alone in seeing increases in pet expenditures. In fact, if you look nationwide, according to the APPA, 2016 reflected a 10.7% increase in U.S. pet expenditures. So this is a long-term trend, a more macro basis, this increase in the pet industry. I went back to look at 2009 at the height of the Great Recession. Pet expenditures in the U.S. were just $45 billion yearly at that time. So since that point, we've seen around 30% growth, and Tractor Supply seems as though they are positioned to take advantage of this growth, not only in their mainstream Tractor Supply Company stores, but also in their expanding PetSense concept. Also, we mentioned livestock being an area of strength for Tractor Supply. The U.S. livestock feed additives market is expanding quite rapidly, and this is for a number of reasons. But again, Tractor Supply is well positioned to make a jump here, and they didn't discuss this specifically in the earnings report beyond just saying that livestock sales were up, or sales surrounding livestock were up. Tractor Supply Company has prebiotics and probiotics that have become increasingly popular for a number of reasons. These are these feed additives we talk about. Disease outbreaks in livestock populations are always an industry threat to the nation's protein sources, but now more than ever, this is the case due to the fact that U.S. regulatory bodies have made stricter protocols on introducing new antibiotics. Both federal and state pressure on farmers with this has grown. Consumers are also much more caring about not only the medications livestock take, but how they are fed in general. Some more natural additives are now being targeted on Tractor Supply Company's shelves in order to address not only the micro trends, but some of these macro market conditions we talked about, not only with pets, but also here with livestock. And it'll be interesting to see Over the short-term future, if Tractor Supply Company identifies this as a major growth catalyst, or if they continue to keep product standouts in the bigger categories where they're seeing results already, it is incumbent, of course, on them to try and conform to what they're seeing from the industry as a whole in terms of trends. But strength already here in livestock feed and livestock additives for Tractor Supply, and that's something that can't really be affected by the weather, so it makes them a little bit more weatherproof, as we've seen in previous earnings calls them blame weather for poor results.
Speaking of calls, during this latest conference call for their second quarter, we pulled out some interesting notes from the earnings transcript. We see that while same-store sales were strong with transactions, as I had mentioned, online traffic was also up 28% in terms of unique page views. So this is extremely important as they have looked to expand their investment, their capital expenditures in the e-commerce space. And this is something we've talked about for quarters now, that they really are trying to be an omni-channel based company. And they mentioned solid performance in most categories outside of the stronger pets and livestock categories. And a lot of this was bolstered by marketing their e-commerce side of things. So you see omni-channel with a completed rollout of buy online, pick up in store. This happened in April officially. Every store had this capability, and this is where they hope to add average basket size to join those in-store transaction numbers that I discussed. Buy online, pickup in stores represented 50% of online sales, so they're really able to convert those customers, get them to the stores to pick up those items, get that free shipping, and also take a look around the store and perhaps buy some of the other things that are at the register, some little smaller priced items that carry those bigger margins. And you see that they are rolling out some new key initiatives. We talk about capital expenditures with e-commerce. Now you look towards the initiatives for the brick and mortar side of the operation and Tractor Supply. You see that they mentioned new LED lighting, a lot of retrofitting the ceilings there at some of their brick and mortar stores. And they mentioned supply chain enhancements in order to make things a little bit more smoother with this omni-channel rollout. Obviously, anytime you have a buy online, pick up in store process, it's going to be a little bit harder on those local distributors to make sure that everything is fulfilled in a timely manner. And this is one of the key problems that a lot of retailers have had with buy online, pick up in store, because somebody may get a notification that something's entered the store, and then when you get to the store, it magically doesn't appear. And so a lot of times this is very important to make sure it happens, even though it may be a little more costly to set up the infrastructure in the beginning. It's important to have this as your program is rolling out. And you see that higher payroll investment, which they said will actually lead to better service, and they didn't say that directly tied in to their omni-channel capabilities, but it would be hard for me to think that they didn't actually supply some more people, some more staffing to ensure that this transition went a little more smoothly inside these locations. And so overall, you tend to like these improvements, both in the e-commerce side and the brick and mortar side. A lot of smart investing by the company, a company that is extremely profitable. They have the ability to put their money towards key areas where they have not seen a lot of competition from entrants yet in the e-commerce realm. You talk about pet supplies, Trent. That is a great example of where somebody like Tractor Supply Company can differentiate and really be Amazon proof in order to take a hold of key areas in certain markets. And that ties right into the rewards membership named Neighbors Club that now touch all stores as of April as well. So you see that buy online, pick up in store around that April timeframe really coincides with their membership program that had rolled out. And now they said the program is growing more than ever. And like with GNC that we'll discuss here in a bit, they are looking to leverage customer buying habits through their loyalty program. And by that, I mean looking into that customer data, because if you were to sign up for the Neighbors Club membership in your local Tractor Supply Company, you have to give forth some information. They use that information and correlate that to what you buy so they can see some of those larger trends. And actually, they're talking about relating that to overall market. So if you're buying something online, perhaps they realize that that item correlates better with something in the store. Therefore, they'll promote that on their website as maybe like a side item or a substitute good. While it's been done for years in such retailers as Kroger, data from customers is proving valuable no matter the sector. So even a company like Tractor Supply Company can use customer data to really make smart decisions on what to market and what to place. Really, you think of store merchandising as a key feature for retailers for the longest time. If you put something on the end cap, what does it go with, you know? And so those are the types of fundamental things that Tractor Supply is looking at. I think very smart decisions by executive teams here with Tractor Supply. And you see that they are optimistic about their pilot mobile point of sale operating system. And they see that customers can actually check out remotely. So if you're buying something from outside the store, something that's not in the actual brick and mortar part of the store, but something that belongs outside the store, like the larger equipment, the larger tractor equipment, you're seeing that these mobile point of sale systems that are being piloted in some unique locations are actually being able to have the person in and out of that transaction without actually having to go inside the store. So a very smart way to look at customer convenience. A system also utilizes inventory and other tools to identify where products may be within the store, making the overall experience a little bit quicker for that customer. And that ties right in to their increased customer service initiatives that they've been talking about for years now. They actually said during the analyst Q&A on the conference call that customer service levels were at all-time highs now with the company. However, they didn't provide any surveys that were cited. A lot of companies have in-house surveys that rate on a scale of 0 to 10 their level of happiness when they exit the retailer. But overall, you see that they said they are a 24/7 retailer, meaning now that they're omnichannel. But not only that, they spoke about combining digital with brick and mortar as they are really bullish on their website. And again, trying to combine the two, they want customers to think digital when they think Tractor Supply Company, which is often weird to think about with a company that specializes in things that are for rural areas. They want customers to think digital when they think Tractor Supply Company.
An interesting pivot for them because they've been left relatively behind in terms of technological advancements. You mentioned mobile point of sale systems. A lot of other brick and mortar retailers have that type of thing in place. Let's talk very quickly about store openings and their stock. They opened 14 Tractor Supply Company locations, one Dell's store, and 8 PetSense locations. They now have 1,630 Tractor Supply locations in 49 states and 160 PetSense stores, which we mentioned earlier, in 26 states. They bought back $134 million in stock during this last quarter, and now their earnings per share outlook for the full year is in range of $3.22 to $3.27 per share, which is actually lowered guidance by an average of about 23 cents per share. Still, the market liked what they brought to the table because same-store sales is projected to stay steady around 2 to 3%. Tractor Supply also increased capital expenditures, leading to the idea that maybe they're seeing more potential growth opportunities than before. Speaking of growth, their stock did some growing on Wednesday. It grew 4% Wednesday and another 7% on Thursday, rebounding from what had been a four-year low. Recently touched as low as $49 per share, which was their lowest point since March of 2013. All-time highs took place in May of 2016 at $97 per share. Now shares are hovering right around the $57 per share mark, leaving them with a price-to-earnings ratio of 17 and a total market cap of $7.4 billion. After this message from the Lightspeed Speaker Series, we'll discuss the rent-to-own retail sector and have an update on whether the impact from one new GNC is yet visible on the company's financials. More to come from Retail Focus.
Think back to when you started your business. You had a dream. You had boundless passion. You wanted to create something different. There was a problem, and you were going to solve it. Being an independent retailer is rewarding, but challenging, and there's a lot more to it than you ever imagined. Well, Lightspeed is here to help. With 45,000 customers around the world, we've helped countless entrepreneurs nail the business side of retail so they can spend time doing what they're passionate about. Join us for a six-week speaker series featuring a curated panel of experts that will answer some of retail's toughest questions and give you the edge you need to stay competitive. You have a passion, and we have a passion for technology inspired by you. Visit lightspeedhq.com/speaker-series to learn more.
As we return, we get into a sector we don't discuss often, the sales and lease ownership retail sector. They were in the news this week as Aaron's revealed their second quarter earnings and their stock popped over 13% in early trading on Friday. Not only is Aaron's lease purchase model unique to this show, they're also fairly heavily franchised for a retailer, which we can actually say of our last two stories, or the companies making up our last two stories. Rent-to-own businesses thrive on contracts where people can lease tangible goods such as computers, televisions, furniture, large appliances, all this for an agreed-on period of time. Unlike most consumer lines of credit, many agreements have customers paying weekly or bi-weekly. Aaron's is beginning to shift more towards a monthly model. Per these agreements, customers have the right to buy their leased items if they pay off the remaining balance at the end of the lease. Customers also have the ability to cut the lease off at the end of each payment period and exit the agreement upon returning the goods. According to an FTC survey from 2000, people who shopped at rent-to-own shops said they utilized the structure for a number of reasons, but most particularly, no credit report checking, flexibility, and convenience. Keep those things in mind for later on in the story. Common complaints were of the higher-than-average pricing, which of course has to exist for rent-to-own places to make a consistent profit. As for Aaron's, they were founded back in 1955. The rent-to-own retailer has grown through acquisition and the aforementioned franchisee business model. They had a corporate furnishing business at one point in time that actually sold to Berkshire Hathaway back in 2008, but they are currently an S&P 400 component. Their stores are comprised of a mix of approximately one-third franchised and two-thirds company-owned stores. They have just under 1,100 company stores and around 680 franchise stores as of right now. Key initiatives that were brought forth 3 years ago for Aaron's were more in line with the norms in the retail industry rather than the rent-to-own industry. These initiatives included goals for same-store sales growth and more of an e-commerce presence. And while they might have more of an e-commerce presence, Leighton, it became clear from these second quarter results, despite the fact that the stock popped by so much, they are not seeing that same-store sales growth that they wanted back in 2014.
No, they have not. But, you know, you see the business overall, and it's operating fairly well. They divide their business up into three parts: Aaron's Operations, Progressive Leasing, which is their virtual lease-to-own business, and Dentamed Incorporated, which is a second-look financing corporation. Here, we're more concerned with the Aaron's results, and we'll get to this in a second. Revenues for the company overall were up slightly year-over-year at $815.6 million versus $789 million in the fiscal year 2016, and this is reflective of a 3.32% increase. However, earnings were slightly down, as was expected on Wall Street, $36.3 million this year versus $38.5 million last year. And on a diluted earnings per share basis, 51 cents this year versus 53 cents last year. On the non-GAAP side of things, non-GAAP earnings were actually up, $48.5 million versus $43.3 million last year. Non-GAAP accounts for the effects of amortization expenses and the acquisition from Progressive Leasing back in 2014. Again, this is sort of akin to that REIT measure that we were talking about a little bit later, where non-GAAP measures can factor in things like amortization expenses and so forth. Again, we consider this part of the acquisition process. So take non-GAAP with a grain of salt here. And you see overall, cash on hand is down about $48 million from the same time last year, $308 million to about $260.3 million now. This is largely due to the amortization costs of the acquisition mentioned earlier. They generated $115.6 million in cash from operations through the first two quarters. So the company as a whole appears fairly healthy, but what about Aaron's specifically? And this is where things, Trent, get really interesting, as Aaron's specific revenues were down 10.7% in the second quarter. Again, this is the major part of their business. You look at why these Aaron's revenues were down, and first, they sold off their HomeSmart business during the second quarter. If you exclude HomeSmart's impact on Aaron's revenue, the decrease is still 9.3%. Second, some of their business is transitioning to the Progressive Leasing segment of their business, whose revenues were up 25%, more than offsetting the losses at Aaron's company-wide. And third, they are flat out struggling in this division, and they were even worse off than they were in the first quarter. We see lease revenue and fees were down 11.7%. Merchandise sales to franchisees were down 4.1%. So you can see that overall demand is tapering for Aaron's right now, Trent. And if you look through the company, you can see that same-store revenues also were down for the company.
Yeah, same store revenues for company-owned stores down 8.1% year-over-year. This is a product of both transaction size, or that basket size, if you will, down 3.3%, and customer count, which is down 4.8%. As for franchisee-owned stores, same store sales were down 6.1%, and customer counts were down 4.5%. So regardless of whether they're franchised stores or company-owned stores, same store sales down by 6 to 8% across the board. All of these struggles, not only the same store sales, but also the ones that Leighton mentioned, have led to an adjustment in store count. 62 company stores were closed during this last quarter. 6 franchise stores were either consolidated or closed as well. So this also means a decrease in franchise royalties and fees. Above and beyond just the closed stores, franchise royalties and fees were down 13.2%. for the second quarter year over year, in part because of the plummeting same store sales, and in part because some of these stores were not bringing in quite as much money in the lease to own agreements. However, many of these declines that we're talking about weren't unexpected. They actually increased guidance on top line revenue after this earnings call. Now $3.33 billion for the full year to $3.44 billion versus $3.1 to $3.3 billion from before. And they increased bottom line guidance as well, with earnings per share numbers expected to be around $2.10 per share to $2.30 per share versus $1.85 to $2.10 per share earlier. But all of this information regarding the Aaron's specific issues that the company is having led us to wonder, why are they having struggles in this rent-to-own type of model? Well, this sector of retail is having a pretty tough time in general. Rent-A-Center, who released earnings earlier this week, showed sequential growth but still lost 17 cents per share in the quarter. Sequential growth, as we'll discuss later in our story with GNC, is a little bit of a tricky number since their same-store sales were still down year over year despite a massive number of store closures and getting rid of some of the underperforming stores. By massively decreased same-store sales, we mean 10.2% against a year-over-year decline back in 2016 of 6.9%. So the two-year stack sits over 17% decline in same-store sales for Rent-A-Center, not talking Aaron's here, but Rent-A-Center rather. So the answer as to why this sector is having so many struggles may in fact lie in macroeconomic factors such as wage inflation and unemployment rate declines. Now, logically, it stands to reason that people won't agree to paying more for a product long term if they've got the money or the credit available to buy it up front. During the Great Recession, it appears as though, based on sales numbers for Aaron's, more people were willing to accept longer term costs for short term gain for the type of merchandise that Aaron's offered. And so we're making the assumption here that people won't make these expenditures at Aaron's when they've got money to spend up front and they can save a little bit of money rather than going to a rent-to-own place. But this is also borne out in the data. It's not just our assumption. When you look at Aaron's and particularly their stock, they're somewhat of a rare bird on the stock market because their beta is negative 0.26. Now, for those that are unfamiliar with that term, stocks with negative betas tend to fluctuate the opposite direction of the rest of the stock market. So when things are going well for the market or the economy as a whole, things go poorly for Aaron's and vice versa. When the market is doing poorly, Aaron's succeeds. Now, Rent-A-Center, their cousins, they don't have a negative beta, but they do have a beta significantly below 1. Their beta is at 0.35. A 1 beta means that a stock fluctuates exactly as the market fluctuates. So Rent-A-Center still fluctuates a little bit as the market goes. They're not opposite the market like Aaron's is, but they don't fluctuate as much as what the market does when the market is doing well. Although Aaron's is beating their own admittedly poor expectations, you have to see something there that can maybe pull them out of this hole that they're in terms of sales numbers, other than hoping for an economic downturn. And for them, it may start with diversification. They can sell products outright. They certainly have that option. They might be able to draw in customers who now have the finances to purchase things immediately. You have to hope if they do this that in the financial downturn, they might have built some brand awareness with previous customers, so they might be able to leverage this And also, because of their unique business model, that means they have stores in low-income or rural areas that might be able to leverage their brick-and-mortar status as kind of the only game in town to increase sales. Alternatively, they could offer lower rates on the rent-to-own front, but this doesn't seem to make any sense either because the people using those services aren't any less likely to default on the lease in the end. So basically, it looks as though for Aaron's, they just need to tread water or continue to diversify their portfolio of services with the internet-based services Leighton was mentioning and with their loan services until they get benefit from another downturn, which sounds really weird to say for a retailer hoping for a downturn, but certainly seems to be the case here for Aaron's.
A very interesting dynamic there with Aaron's and a very nice look into the rent-to-own market. We look to our last story on an update from the one new GNC refresh, and it's still not looking great for the company as same-store sales were down 0.9% over the same quarter a year ago. The first thing they did mention in the earnings release header is that they have seen growth in sequential same-store sales, which is a fairly useless metric. We tend to look at same-store sales looking back from the same period a year ago. This is interesting in that the company has come back in a new refreshed way. They're piloting a lot of stores with new merchandising. They have a new website, and they now have a brand new relationship with Amazon that we mentioned last quarter. They're rolling out their new Amazon storefront, and they cited success in a multitude of areas. But first, we delve into the financials, the second quarter results for GNC, and we see that adjusted earnings per share came in ever so slightly above expectations at 41 cents per share. Analysts were calling for just 40 cents per share. Top line revenue of $640.9 million missed analyst expectations by $8 million. That was the biggest miss you'll find here for this earnings report. Business is comprised of both brick and mortar and their wholesale and manufacturing, the private label products division. By revenue, 82% of their stores is their business, while the rest is from the wholesale division. North American revenues consist of both Canada and the United States. That decreased on the retail front 4.8%. Wholesale sales were down 8.9%. International revenue actually ticked up slightly, 1.3% growth there, which was the one bright spot, mostly a function of Chinese e-commerce. And you see a 1.1% drop in same-store sales franchise stores, a 0.9% drop in those company-owned stores. And perhaps company-owned stores are executing changes a little bit more effectively as they transition everyone back into the one new GNC model. And you see transactions have been growing and management is pleased with the loyalty numbers thus far, with 7.3 million consumers signing up for those membership reward programs. Already 80% of their enrollment goal. Keep in mind their previous membership program tied in several members to this new one, but it looks as though their traffic numbers is indicative of the fact that this marketing campaign, the overall image of the One New GNC is potentially working. Let's remember that they do have a two-tier loyalty program, one that's free and one that's labeled Pro Access that is not free. The Pro Access actually now has 325,000 members, which is actually pretty good considering the annualized fee of $39.99. So that's just cash in their pocket, especially for those members that aren't going to be taking advantage of every single deal through that particular program. But they cited strong performance on their Amazon storefront. And Trent, if you mull through the earnings call details, the conference call details, you can see that management is explaining the one new GNC. That really has everything to do with the customer experience. It exists, their transformation exists in order to try to rebrand themselves, yes, but to also give customers a better experience, trying to give them a personalized experience coming into each individual store.
But the big question with the one new GNC, management can talk about the customer experience all they want. Are they seeing the proof in the pudding? And currently, GNC claims that they're seeing traffic momentum carrying through what we have so far in the third quarter. So they're about a month into the third quarter. But this traffic momentum is relative since traffic has been down significantly over the past 2 years, particularly when you look at it on a year-over-year basis. They also want to end their addiction to excessive promotion in BOGOs, what they said during the earnings call. Those are the buy one, get one half off or buy one, get one free promotions that GNC has become known for. This will certainly help to prevent them from devaluing their own products. But at the same time, you talk about customer experience, this might alienate customers short term if you don't provide them meaningful discounts in other areas. They also discuss streamlined pricing. This sounds all very, very familiar, like the JCPenney's of 5 to 6 years ago. But the streamlined pricing is something that we noted when they first rolled out one new GNC. They're starting to gather this data from new membership. This is something they can compare with their Amazon data fairly easily, in our opinion. They spoke of trying to recommend certain products for those customers of other products. This is where they'll be able to capitalize on in-house brands and those accompanying margins, since they're taking a hit on other margin areas. What is interesting and worrisome here is that GNC branded product sales, so their private label products, declined in the US and Canada this quarter. So despite the fact that they're seeing whatever traffic momentum they're referencing, they're not being able to sell their own branded products as much as they were in the prior year's quarter. Speaking of these margins that we've discussed, you get the vibe that they're very worried about margins going forward, especially when you factor in the capital expenditures they're making in the online space. But unfortunately for GNC, pricing is a must to compete in the supplements industry now. Now, not all of the earnings call was tied in with great customer service and meeting personal needs, nor is all of the One New GNC initiative tied into this. They're trying to push smaller point-of-sale items towards the front of the store, akin to bubblegum at a larger general merchandise retailer, like candy bars, that type of thing. GNC is trying to push a few impulse buys at the front of the store, and it's important to have these things, sure, but important to not push them outside of good signage, in our opinion. Also, based on what we've seen so far from GNC, they've had a bad habit of cluttering their point of sale space with impulse buys. And with all this clutter, this deteriorates the customer's ability to single out an item for purchase. It becomes all noise then, and they just kind of factor all of that stuff out, push all of it to the back burner. So they need to perhaps adjust their point of sale approach if they're looking at impulse buys as a way to drive top line revenue. Selling, general, and administrative expenses for GNC, let's talk about that now. They came in higher than last year as well, at 24% of sales. The company blamed this on online marketing, where they spent $6 million. What is worrisome here is they're expecting that higher 24 to 25% level to maintain itself for the rest of the fiscal year. For reference, I went to Natural Grocers by Vitamin Cottage to see what their recent SG&A was. It was 25.4% during their last quarter, though they're very much in a growth stage and their administrative expenses are lower, just 2.6% of sales. So you have one company going in one direction with that 25% SG&A. You have another company that's closing stores, trying to refresh things, and they have that high level of SG&A, and that's why we're a little bit concerned about that.
We look at the continued restructuring for the brand. Again, the One New GNC has taken place in some other brick and mortar stores, but not all. You see, they said during the conference call they're looking to consolidate, close around 200 to 250 company-owned locations as they look at their real estate portfolio. And that really does make it sound like they're closely looking at upcoming leases, which is never good when a company is looking at just the lease agreements as far as the financial performance, keeping those locations open going forward. They're doing a lot of the pilot stores in part, so the chances are the stores they're remodeling are not going to be the company-owned locations that they're looking to close in the upcoming year. So that's a wise investment to really be thinking about the mid to long-term consequences of closing your stores and the overall effects of rebranding. They're looking to have stricter inventory measures, which is something they've talked about in the past, but you really don't see it bear out in the numbers. For them, it's extremely important because with a merchandise model that they have, you don't walk into a supplement store and buy six or seven of one particular item. Typically, you only buy one or two that fits you and then come back when you need it. And that's actually what the membership program with One New GNC promotes, is the idea of you keep coming back to their stores, to their online space. But overall, the company is saying and partially doing all of the right things to sustain their market share and keep brand equity. However, you have to look at the overall things that they're doing. Partnering with Amazon, again, one of their lead competitors, is that going to be a smart decision for the long run? You see, the problem may be with that. Everything is a little too late for One New GNC. Malls, of course, we say this all the time, will exist in the long term, But the traffic declines are real, and meanwhile, those customers that buy health supplements on a regular basis have shifted in part to the online space, and that's where a lot of fitness forums are, a lot of expertise, a lot of fitness trainers now exist in the online space where they can recommend their own products to try to drive customers away from brick and mortar places like GNC. And you see that shareholders overall, they like the news on the financial front as shares rose nearly 12% on Wednesday in after hours trading. Overall, Trent, the company has a lot of things to overcome as the management does recognize they are still in a state of transition. They have only begun to relay this to their core customer.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the conclusion of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I give our take on what we're looking ahead to over the next week or the next month, and we begin with Leighton.
My story has to do with Amazon, the U.S.'s largest e-commerce retailer, as Amazon is still looking into having cashier-less checkout projects happen, and they really are bullish on this idea, even though the technology hasn't been as reliable as they'd like it to be in their pilot locations. You're looking at locations where their company headquarters are. The company says they're still looking to determine how customers want to shop for groceries, and they think that customer service is going to be the key for the future. This comes by way of the fact that the acquisition is still on between Amazon and Whole Foods, and this is something that a lot of analysts are going to be looking towards as the company hopes to save money in the Whole Foods model. Are they going to be looking at cashierless checkout lanes in Whole Foods, and is that going to hurt the morale of those employees? But for now, it looks as though the online giant has experienced big sales and they're looking to put forth those contribution margins into more technology and into more development for these types of things in store. And so you look at the operating power that it takes, the network capacity that it takes to be able to track everybody's shopping cart and really check them out without any problems with ease, and you see that this is going to cost a lot of money for Amazon, but this is obviously money that Amazon is willing to put forth in order to give customers that added experience and potentially save money on that bottom line.
I'm looking ahead at BJ's Wholesale Club because they are continuing their omni-channel stretch. Now, prior to about the last couple of years, they've really struggled with digital sales, but now they're launching a mobile site that customers can use from their phones, in fact. And not only does it allow them to look at products and order products, but it also gives them access to services like deli and bakery ordering, which could be a huge next step for BJ's Wholesale Club. Either way, you have to like the fact that they are now focusing on omni-channel approaches, even though they probably put that on the back burner for far too long. So give them credit. BJ's, just as a refresher, they are the third largest warehouse club operator in the U.S. behind Costco and Sam's Club. They operate 215 clubs in 16 states, most of these on the East Coast. That'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Make sure and follow us online. You can follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast. Also, make sure you subscribe to our podcast on whatever the podcast listening service of your choice is. And also, if you like us, rate it. We'll see you next week. We're going to have a jam-packed food focus. We'll talk about Starbucks closing Teavana locations, and we'll talk about Del Taco's surging same-store sales.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.